Good afternoon, ladies. We're studying Perashat Bamidbar, the first parasha in the fourth book of the Torah. The parasha is called Bamidbar because of the first pasuk that says God spoke to Moshe in the Midbar Sinai, in the wilderness of Sinai, at Ohel Moed. That's where they communicated. And he told them to take a census of the people, to count the people. And then the Torah lists exactly each tribe, how many people they had, etc. There's a midrash right in the beginning of the parasha that says the Torah is compared to three things. It's compared to fire, it's compared to water, and it's compared to a desert, to a midbar. Hachamim struggled to try to understand this midrash. You see, many midrashim are cryptic. The rabbis write a sentence and they don't interpret it. So they leave it up to the scholar to try to delve into the meaning. What did the rabbis mean when they said the Torah is compared to fire, it's compared to water, it's compared to a desert? So I saw today a novel interpretation of this midrash. If you think about it, Jews in general have a certain stubbornness to them, religious, not religious, a certain tenacity, a certain ability to overcome, to fight, to prevail. Just think about our history. We've been prosecuted, persecuted, pogromed, holocausted throughout the centuries in every land, whether it was in Germany or whether it was in Spain. But the Jewish nation, with its stiff neck attitude, has the ability to overcome it and survive it, and we don't give in too easily. No, much less strong-willed people or nations might have just said, you know, it's not worth it, let's just give in, let's forget about the Torah, let's forget about religion. It's easier that way. We'll make all the goyim happy, we'll just become assimilated and finish. But the Jews cling on. Where did they get this from? So one rabbi said, we inherited this trait, like most traits are inherited from parents. We inherited a trait from Avraham Avinu. The first official Jew, we'll call him, had a very dominant trait, and that was, when it came to religion, he was steadfast in his opinion. When did this manifest? When the king of his time, a fellow called Nimrod, told Avraham Avinu that if you don't forego your religion, I'm going to throw you into a fire, a fiery furnace, Kivshan Ha'esh. Avraham Avinu says, I cannot forego my religion, throw me into the fire, I'll die, but I will not let my religion go out. And sure enough, Nimrod threw Avraham Avinu in the fire, and Avraham Avinu came out miraculously. That fire that Avraham Avinu jumped into, that's the source of our strength. How Jews throughout the generations are able to sacrifice and overcome all the problems and obstacles that are placed in front of us and still remain Jewish, even in American society. Thank God we don't have the persecution of Germany and of Spain towards the end. But America has its own challenges and its own obstacles that are anti-Torah. It's quite difficult to retain and hold on. Where do we get that strength from? That's the dominant gene of Avraham Avinu that's willing to jump into a fire in order to hold on to his religion and his convictions. Hence, when we say the Torah is compared to fire, it's referring to the fire that Avraham Avinu jumped into. But somebody might ask, Rabbi, that's only one man. Do we see collectively, do we see the Jews as a group that were willing to sacrifice for God? And the answer is certainly. We saw it at the time we left Egypt. At the time the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, we were sandwiched in. There was the sea on one side of us and the Egyptians on the other side. And God told Moshe, tell the people, go. Let go. Where are we going? It's a sea. We're going to drown. And the Jewish people, with a great leap of faith, started to walk into the sea, not knowing that it was going to split, mind you. The Jews had every intent that if we have to drown as a result, then we're going to drown. But God said to walk in, we walk in. Hence, when we left Egypt, at that moment, collectively, the Jewish people created a gene of endurance that we're willing to even drown, Chas v'Shalom, but to fulfill the word of God. Avraham in fire, the Jews collectively in water. Hence the Torah is compared to water. But somebody might say, Rabbi, these tests of Avraham and the Jewish people leaving Egypt, as noble as they are, and as successful as they were, it was for moments. You know, it was a split second of sacrifice. You know, they jumped into the fire, he jumped into the fire. How long does that take? A second. You know, you just have to make a snap decision, jump in, and it's over. The Jews jumped into the water. It was immediate. There wasn't a long, drawn-out self-sacrifice. So the rabbis tell us the Torah is compared to the desert. The Jewish people were in the desert for 40 years. I don't have to tell you what was in that desert. Try walking into a desert at night where there's animals and there's snakes and there's scorpions and there's elements and there's enemies on the side of you, and you have to have total trust in God that nobody's going to attack and there's not going to be any bandits and there's not going to be any Chas v'Shalom wild animals that are going to attack and bite and poison. All these things they were faced with every single day. And where was food? They had to rely not on the pantry that they had. They had to rely that maybe tomorrow morning some food's going to rain from heaven. Where was their water? They had to rely on miraculously a well that was following them. For 40 years, the Jewish people were willing to live a supernatural existence of self-sacrifice for God. Hence the Torah is compared to the Midbar. Those three incidents in Jewish history. The fire of Avraham Avinu. And the waters that the Jewish people crossed in Egypt. And the Midbar that the Jewish people lived through for 40 years. That created what we have today as a final product, the Jewish people. We draw from the strength of Avraham, the strength of those Jews that crossed the sea, and those Jews that were willing to live a life of self-sacrifice in the Midbar. And that's why God bless the ladies as yourselves, with such a turbulent world that we live in, that materialism and indulgence is pulling us all from every side, from everywhere we go. Torah study, as much as a renaissance period we're having in the world with Torah, it's still not as vogue or as fashionable as it should be. So for ladies to come on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, to dedicate Torah, where do they get that strength from? To swim upstream like salmon, to go against the tide, to go against community standards, to go against world standards, American standards. That's the strength that we inherited, you all being the daughters of Avraham Avinu, you all being the noble descendants of that generation that left Yetziat Mitzrayim and crossed the sea, and certainly descendants of that generation, the generation of the Midbar. The Torah then tells us in the census about the Levi'im, about all the tribes, but specifically the tribe of the Levi'im. And one thing we do notice, that out of all the tribes, the tribe of Levi was the smallest in number. Even today, in synagogue, it's very hard to come across a Levi. It's very often that when we need to send up a Levi for the Torah, there's not a Levi to be had. They're rare. They're not extinct, but they're rare. So all the rabbis ask the same question. Why are Levi'im so rare? What happened to them? The Ramban has a novel interpretation. He says, you know, the Jews in Egypt were blessed with multiple births. Most of the ladies gave birth six at a time, but every year. There was no fertility problems in Egypt. And that's why the Jewish people multiplied. And the Torah tells us, why did God bless them with such berachah, having six at a time? It's because Paro, he tried to squash the population. Paro said, I'm going to work them hard, I'm going to break their spirit, I'm going to break their morale, and therefore they'll diminish on their own. So God said, you're going to try to break the Jewish people? I'm going to show you that the more you try to break them, the more they flourish. The Pasuk writes, V'ka'asher ya'anu oto, the more Paro torture us, ken yirveh v'chen yifrotz, the more the Jewish people multiplied. Says the Ramban, there was one tribe, however, that did not work in Egypt. There was one tribe, the clergy, that was exempt from any work, and that was the tribe of Levi. So the tribe of Levi, while they benefited from not having kasher ya'anu oto, they were redeemed from the suffering of Paro, but because of that, they didn't get the blessing that came with it. Only those that suffered in Egypt, only those that were hit, multiplied. But those that sat in the yeshiva, whatever they were doing, studying, so yeah, on one side you have a great advantage. There's no work. But on the other side, there is no benefit either. Hence the tribe of Levi remained from the smallest tribes. But there's another fascinating interpretation that I recently saw in a book called Be'er Yosef. He has a theory like this. It's actually ingenious the way he put it together. His theory goes as follows. All the plagues that were in Egypt, Dam, Sefardeya, Kinim, etc., each plague came for a certain reason. Why did God afflict the Egyptians with Dam? Why blood? There has to be a reason. Yes, it's inconvenient. Yes, it's a torture. It's measure for measure. But what exactly? Why blood? So Hachamim tell us that Paro had a plan. Paro said he knows the Jewish ladies, even before the Torah was given. They had a tradition from Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, their mothers, that they go to the mikveh. So therefore, Paro outlawed and banned mikveh. That any mikveh is built, he'll kill them. Any lady that gets caught in the mikveh, death penalty. And therefore, what was his plan actually? His plan was, if the ladies can't go to the mikveh, so they won't be pure, they won't be able to be with their husbands, hence the population will be diminished. This was a sinister plot. So God tells Paro, so to speak, you did not let the ladies purify themselves from their blood. So therefore, now the whole Egypt is going to turn into dam, measure for measure. Now wait, he goes further. He says, what happened? But what happened? He says, we have a law that's written in Shulchan Aruch, in the laws of Nidah. It's not taught because it's not so applicable, but it's a halakha nonetheless. Halakha tells us a little about the biology and the nature of a lady regarding the law of Nidah. Halakha tells us that certain things can cause a lady to become Nidah, and certain things can actually refrain the lady from becoming Nidah. Example, the Gemara says, if a lady is suddenly frightened or shocked, suddenly this can cause Nidah. The Gemara brings an example from Esther, Queen Esther. It says Queen Esther was sitting in the palace one day, and all of a sudden she sees Mordechai crying, nervous. She says, what's going on over here? So she gets the message back, and the message is told to her suddenly that there's a plot against the Jewish people, Holocaust, they're going to kill everybody. So the pasuk in Megillat Esther says, "V'titchalchal hamalka." She shook, she got scared. Gemara says she became nida on the spot because of the shock. The Gemara says, however, on the other side of the coin, if people are living in constant fear, not in sudden fear, in constant fear, for example, during wartime, where there's constant tension in the air and there's uncertainty what's going to be, that causes the nida not to happen. So watch what happened in Egypt. Paro says, I'm not going to let the ladies go to the mikveh so they won't be able to become pure. But what happened? In Egypt, for 210 years, the Jewish ladies and the Jewish men, they were under constant fear. Pacha, they don't know what Paro could do. You're living under a tyrant. Any day he can, who knows what. So the ladies, miraculously, for 210 years, they didn't get nidah. And since they didn't get nidah, they didn't need to go to the mikveh. So therefore, it backfired in Paro's face. Ah, but says the rabbi, there was one tribe, however, that wasn't living in fear. And that's the tribe of Nevi. The tribe of Nevi, they were learning, they were happy, Paro was good to them. So therefore the ladies of Nevi had normal cycles. And since the mikvaot were closed, so therefore the Nevi'im weren't able to multiply as the rest of the people. What a beautiful calculation, the way the rabbi came out with it. In any event, that's the second reason why we don't have as many Levi'im as we have the rest of the tribes. There's another idea that the Mesilat Yesharim talks about. Mesilat Yesharim was a book written by a great scholar, a rabbi called Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato. In English, they call it Path of the Just. And in this sefer, in the 20th chapter, he talks about a concept that he calls Mishkal HaHasidut. What is this Mishkal HaHasidut? In religion, there's levels. There's Ama'aris, which is ignoramus. And then as you elevate yourself, you can become a Sadiq. And after Sadiq, there's already Hasid. Sadiq is somebody that does everything he's asked to do. A Hasid is somebody that does more than he's asked to do. Somebody that loves his father doesn't only get away with listening to specific instruction. If his father asks him for water, he brings him water and a napkin and a plate and some kak. That's a hasid. He doesn't just bring him water. A sadiq says, well, that's what you asked for. You asked for water. Well, I got your water finished. He follows the instruction. I'm an artist. He tells his father, not now, I'm busy. I'll get it for you later. So those are the levels. Those are the levels. So says the Mesilat Yesharim, when it comes to doing things in the level of Hasidut, when we want to do things, let's say, above what we're asked to do, he says, then you have to take out what he calls a scale. And this scale over here has to constantly be being used to judge whether it's worth it or not worth it. You can't make calculations if it's worth it to keep Shabbat or not. That's non-negotiable. But things that we're doing above the law, then you have to analyze. Am I gaining by doing it? Am I hurting people by doing it? Is it worth it? Not worth it? It's not always the proper path to be always going above the law if there's other circumstances or other ramifications that are going to get affected. His classic example is the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi had a job, and the parasha tells us the job. their job was to carry the Mishkan. You see, the Jews had a tabernacle, which was a transportable Beit HaMikdash. They used to put it together, then they would disassemble it. They would travel. Who was in charge of carrying the Mishkan? The tribe of Levi. That was their job. Now, you have many different vessels in the Mishkan. You have the menorah, you have the shulchan, you have a couple of altars. Of course, you have the key component of the Mishkan, which is the Aron. The Aron has in it the Sefer Torah, the tablets. So he says, what happened? The Levi'im were told, okay, you're in charge of transporting. Every Levi, let's say rightfully so, wanted to get his hands on the Aron. You know, if you can carry the Aron, why do you want to carry the menorah? The Aron is the holiest item. Everybody wants to get next to the Kiddushah. So what was happening was, the other parts of the Mishkan were neglected, and now fights broke out by the Aron, because everybody wants to carry the Aron. So they're pushing, and they're shoving, and they're polling for position, and they're... And it turned into like a mini fight every time they had to move the Mishkan. And as a result of it, the Gemara says, many Levi'im died. Because God says, what do you mean? You're fighting in front of God. Now this is Shekhinah. You're in front of the Aron. You're punching and hitting and shoving. Although you have great intent. Your intent is to get closer to God. Your intent is to carry the Aron. It's Hasidut. Unbelievable. But at what expense? To neglect the rest of the Mishkan? At what expense? To hurt others? To fight? So he says that's a classic example where the scale of Hasidut was not used. Subsequently, God then told Moshe, so this problem won't happen again, to give each family specific positions. This family will carry the Aron, finish. This family carries the menorah, etc. So therefore this cannot happen again. But unfortunately, says Rav Pam, that these scales are constantly being misused. He gives another example from the Gemara. Listen to an interesting Gemara, just so you can get a feeling of what we're talking about. You all know we have an obligation to say Shema in the morning and Shema in the evening. Ladies are not obligated like the men are in this, but they do say Shema every day. There's a great argument between two rabbis, Bet Hillel and Bet Shammai. Bet Hillel says you could say the Kiryat Shema however you like. You want to say it standing up, you can say it standing up. You want to sit and say it, you can say it sitting. You want to say it walking, you can say it walking. There's no protocol. You can say Shema any way you want. Bet Shammai says no. In the morning, you must say Kiryat Shema standing. And in the evening, you must say it lying down. And he learns it from a pasuk. The pasuk says, Ubshokhmecha, Ubkumecha. Shokhmecha means when you're lying down. Ubkumecha means when you're standing up. He learns that's the way you have to say it. That means in the yeshiva of Bet Shammai. In Arbit, when they were about to say Shema, the whole yeshiva would lie on the floor. They would all lie on their benches and say Shema in a reclining position. That was his opinion. Now you can't follow two opinions. The law is either like Bet Hillel or Bet Shammai. A heavenly voice came from Shammayim that the Gemara talks about, because Bet Shammai and Bet Hillel argued on a lot of subjects. There was always controversy between those two schools. A heavenly voice came from Shammayim and said, Rabotai, the halakha is like Hillel. Finished. He's the bottom line. Everybody has to follow Hillel. So the Mishnah tells a story. There was a rabbi called Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Tarfon was once walking down the street and it became evening time. And he said, oh, it's the time of Shema. So he lied down on the street and he read Shema. When he came back to the yeshiva, he told his colleagues, he says, Rabotai, you don't know what happened to me. I went, I was Hasid. I know the halakha doesn't follow Shammai, but I wanted to be Mahmir. I wanted to do a little more. And I went out of my way, and I lied down in the middle of the street, and you know something? Maybe I put myself in danger. Who knows, lying in the middle of the street, I could have been robbed, I could have been mugged. So you know what the rabbis told him? If you got mugged or robbed, you would have deserved it. He was coming to say, oh, what I did, I lied down in the street, I went, I did. So what are you doing there? Now, what was the claim that the rabbis had? The rabbis were telling Rabbi Tarfon, you're right, it's a nice thing, you took a stringent opinion, you lied on the floor, but you know what you did now? If the word gets out that you are following Beit Shammai's opinion, now all the Jewish people are going to say, look, if Rabbi Tarfon follows Beit Shammai, we could follow Beit Shammai. Now already you're causing division amongst the people. God came along with the heavenly voice and said the law follows Beit Hillel, to keep peace amongst the people, so there won't be two Torahs, everybody's following their own thing. And now by you coming to be stringent, that's nice if you were living on an island. But you're living with people now. When the word gets out that you followed Beit Shammai, it's going to confuse everybody. Oh, it's going to be Tafoka, follow Beit Shammai. I also want to follow Beit Shammai. Now already, you're going to have two communities, and they're going to be split, and there's going to be opinions. What the rabbis were telling Rabbi Tarfon on that day was, you didn't take out the scale. You didn't measure it. You didn't weigh exactly if it's worth it or not. We had a rabbi, a great sage with us a few weeks ago in Seudat Shlishit. So when we were together in the kitchen making Netilat Yadayim, so I noticed he was using very little water for whatever reason. So I joked with him. And I said, Rabbi, the maid didn't draw the water. And he laughed and he said, oh, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. And he went on. What happened in that conversation exactly? There's a story told that Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, the great sage, he once came to make Netilat Yadayim, and they saw him using very, very sparse water. He was very, very, miserly with the water. So they told him, Hakam, the Gemara says, whoever washes his hands with a full measure of water, God makes him wealthy. The word Mayim stands for Male Yadenu Mebirchotecha. Fill my hands with your blessings. And God forbid people that don't make Netilat Yadayim, the Gemara says, become poor. The word Ani, Ani stands for Al Netilat Yadayim. Show you the importance of the subject. So it's a rabbi. It's a mitzvah to use a lot of water. What are you using little water for? He says, can I ask you a question? Where did this water come from? They didn't have faucets in those days. They said, no, I mean, the old lady, we have her by the well, she draws the water and she carries it on her back and she brings it. So he says, Salanta says, I should become rich on that old lady's back? She should have to draw extra water so I can become rich. It's one thing if I drew my own water. But now to become a Hasid, to use a lot of water. So that's what I was telling the rabbi that night. Rabbi, we don't have maids that draw the water. It's the government. It's the reservoir. You can use a lot of water. He left. But his reason was, not. After I told him that, he drew, he put the water on. Where he comes from, maybe they have the well still. There's another story told, and I'm never, in my mind, we can never be repetitious in telling stories to impress this concept, because religion always has to be measured. Our performance in religion always has to be measured, it has to be calculated, it has to be weighed. Not everything that seems right is actually right, just because it's a mitzvah or a hasidut, as we're saying. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, the same rabbi, was invited once for a Friday night dinner by one of his students. And he asked the student, you'll forgive me, but could you give me the order of the night, how the night proceeds by you on Friday night? He says, whoa, what a night we have. We come home, the Shalom Aleichem, the Kiddush, the Amotzi, then we sit at least for 3 hours with Pizmonim, with Devre Torah, with speeches, and it's what, and you'll love it, Rabbi. So the rabbi said, I'll come on one condition, that the meal will take no longer than an hour. And then you want to sing, you can sing all night. And then you want to say the Devarei Torah about an hour. The student didn't ask questions. Of course, the rabbi came. They rushed through the meal. After the meal was over, the rabbi said, I'd like to go into the kitchen to thank the lady that prepared the food. This fellow had a widow that used to prepare the food for them and serve the food. So Rishir Salanta says, you'll forgive me, but maybe I caused you to rush tonight to serve the food a little faster than normal. Forgive me? Forgive you, Rabbi? I thank you. These people never end. Usually I work from early in the morning on Friday, and I don't leave until I clean the dishes and leave, and I can't go in there until they finish singing. Baruch Hashem, this is the first time in my life that I'll get home at a decent time. Rabbi Yisrael Salanta was a brilliant man. He was a sensitive man. Singing pizmonim, on whose account you're singing your pizmonim? So the poor widow in the kitchen now has to stay up late at night, and you're singing pizmonim, and you're making Devarei Torah, and it's time after the meal, and I go home. There's a law or a custom, I should say, that God forbid on the yahrzeit, the anniversary of the death of a parent, it's customary that the sons usually get a aliyah to the Torah, and in some communities the children try to be hazan, to lead the services on that day. But you can imagine what happens in big synagogues when, unfortunately, many people are commemorating anniversaries on the same Shabbat, and there's only a limited amount of aliyot that can be given. And, of course, there's a certain coveted aliyah that everybody wants. So you can imagine the fights that break out between people. I want mashlim, I want to be the azan. And we see it all the time, unfortunately. Now, this is hasidut. If you think, one of the Gedolim said, what do you think is going to bring the deceased more pleasure? Getting an aliyah after you turned over the whole shul and made mahloket and you screamed and you yelled, you think that's going to be... So you're right, you got an aliyah. So let's say the aliyah is worth 10 points. But what you had to do to get it is negative 1,000 points. So the deceased, you put him in negative territory. So therefore, in that case, says some of the great rabbis, it's not worth it. Better to refrain from making mahloket and keep a peace in that case, and that'll be more valuable. That'll be more valuable than the aliyah. The Hafetz Chaim once had guests on Friday night. So they came in, and immediately when they stood at the table, they were about to sing the customary Shalom Aleichem. The Hafetz Chaim picked up the Kiddush cup. Savri Maranan. They said, unbelievable. The Hafetz Chaim doesn't say Shalom Aleichem. We can't believe it. They sat down. They started eating. They were shocked. So one of them couldn't control them. He says, Hacham, Shalom Aleichem. The custom, the minhag. So he said, certainly you're hungry. Certainly you didn't eat all day long. For me to greet the angels can wait. They're not so hungry. They don't have to eat. It's more important that we feed hungry people before we can greet the angels after. They'll wait. They're not going anywhere. Mishkala Hasidut. The Hafetz Chaim always had his scales that measure what's more important, what's not. Now, many times, this can be in life. Even a person has a babysitter. And he tells the babysitter, you know, I'll be home. And then we stay out a little later. And even though you're paying the babysitter wants to go home already. The babysitter doesn't know what times the people are going to come home, 11, 12. Mishkala Hasidut. Somebody else is being affected. But I'm at a wedding dancing. I'm doing a mitzvah. But who's mitzvah? What mitzvah? There's somebody else getting affected by this. You told them you're going to be home by a certain time. So therefore, there always has to be a calculation. Rav Palm was so sensitive. He used to say and announce he was against... Sometimes at the end of weddings, the band finishes playing, so the boys want to keep the action going, so they'll dance for another half hour, hour. So he said, although it's a great mitzvah, but they're not taking into calculation the parents that are tired already, that they have to stay for Sheva Berachot. There's certain family members that they have to stay also, they have obligations. So therefore, by doing this mitzvah of Simchat Hatam v'Kala, you're not taking into calculation who's being affected by this over here. Now again, I'm not giving the rules on any of these cases. Each one of these cases has to be asked. And you cannot make judgments yourself either, because sometimes it's worth it, sometimes it's not worth it. But for sure the scale has to be taken out. It's not automatically one-sided that Hasidut always wins. It has to be measured, it has to be tempered, it has to be analyzed. The Torah then tells us towards the end of the Perasha about the death of Nadav and Avihu. Now, of course, they didn't die in this Perasha. Nadav and Avihu, mind you, were the sons of Aharon. We read about their death in previous Perashiot, but the Torah is rehashing the history. So, of course, it's giving a census. It's counting the people. So it says, well, Aaron only had two sons, not including the two sons that died. So the Pasuk writes, Vayamot Nadav v'Avihu. And Nadav v'Avihu died. Why? Ubanim lo hayu lahim. And they did not have children. Actually, Nadav v'Avihu never got married. And some of the rabbis learned from here that the Pasuk is actually giving you one of the reasons why they died. Because they never got married and never had children. That's the sin that did them in. Ubanim lo hayu lahem. So I saw one of the rabbis ask, this contradicts the other reasons that we learned. The other parasha we learned, one reason is because they came into the Beit HaMikdash on the first day inebriated. They had drinking some wine. That wasn't respectful to come into the Beit HaMikdash drinking wine. Another interpretation we learned was they made a halachic ruling in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. A student is never supposed to make a ruling in halacha in front of his rabbi. So they lacked a certain amount of respect to Moshe. And now we're coming and learning a totally new reason. They have to do with nothing. Because they didn't have children. So I saw a brilliant explanation. The common denominator between the sins of the sons of Aharon, they lacked respect on their level, of course. Whether it was a lack of respect to a holy place, like the Mishkan, or whether it was a lack of respect to Moshe Rabbeinu, who was a holy man, they lacked a certain amount of respect. But human nature is, we're never able to see our own faults. And although it might be clear to others that we're not respectful, but to ourselves, so when I'm respectful, of course I'm respectful. You know, I have the derech eres, of course I have the utmost reverence and kavod. Very difficult for us to see our own flaws. Says Rav Volba, but there's one way clearly to see our flaws exaggerated, magnified, and that's when we have children. Because the flaws of our children can come from nowhere else but the parents. And they're living with us for the whole life. They're seeing everything we do. All our bad habits are going to come into the children. So you might not see it in yourself, but if you see your son disrespectful, you have to think to yourself, well, maybe did I say anything? Did I talk to somebody? Did he learn it from me? Did he see what I did? Because they see everything. I'll give you one example how the children, they pick up everything. Many times, because of our scheduling, our classes at night, we get home late. Since I'm married, I don't think I had dinner with my wife from Monday to Wednesday at home, because we don't get home till 11 o'clock. I'm not complaining. I'm the happiest man in the world. She's also happy, I think, I hope. In any event, my wife has a way of saying always, when I come home, if she's up, of course. Of course, she ate already. But she'll say, before I leave at night, she'll say, if you come home, call me, I'll sit with you. Which is a normal thing. It's a nice thing, I'll sit with you. Now, you don't think when you're saying that, that you're actually teaching your children something at that point. So the other night, I happened to be home. So my daughter had walked in. I said, Rachel, did you eat already? No, I ate already. But if you want, Daddy, I'll sit with you. Now, such for an 8-year-old girl or 9-year-old girl to say such, what do you know that from? What do you mean, you're going to sit with me? Who says you have to sit with me when I'm eating dinner? Why do you have to sit with me? Where did you learn this from? But you see, that's they're learning that. So that only can come from a mother that said that. And the opposite is also true. If a child is arrogant or disrespectful, so when the parent sees that, the parent, just like he likes to take credit for all the good things he sees in the children, oh, he learned that from me, he saw me, went, you know, I did that, I'm a good parent. But you have to take, unfortunately, discredit or credit for the bad. The children are actually a mirror to the flaws of a parent. And that's what the Torah is telling you over here. The real reason why they died was because they walked into the Mishkan drinking. It was disrespect to the Mishkan. The real reason was because they disrespected Moshe, because they said Ahalakha. But you want to know, if they would have had children, they would have seen the flaw and they would have corrected it. So the Torah is coming to tell you the real reason why they ultimately died, because they didn't have children. And therefore they didn't have that mirror to reflect and see their own shortcomings. And therefore, as a result, they died. And that's the value of having children, and that's the value of raising children. I'll leave you with one last idea on this point. The Ten Commandments. There's five commandments on one side, and there's five commandments on the other side. And the commandments are parallel to each other. One is parallel to six, etc. Two to seven. The fifth of the Ten Commandments is honor your parents. Kaved et avicha ve'et imecha. The tenth, which is parallel to it, is do not covet. Lo tachmor, do not be jealous. The Gemara says there's a correlation between honoring parents and do not be jealous. What's the correlation? The Midrash says something like this, that if somebody has a jealous nature and covets his friend's property, he's going to have children that are going to Chas v'Shalom one day curse him and say, I wish so-and-so was my father. So the rabbis ask, what's the psychology here? What does it mean? So they explain very simply. A child doesn't know anything. He just knows what he sees by his parents. And the parents come home along and say, I wish I had this person's money. And I wish I had this person's home. And I wish I was able to take vacations like the other guy. So he's learning now a jealous nature. What commodity does a child have in his life? He only has one thing, his parents. So the only thing he can trade in is his parents. So therefore the jealousy of the parents is going to come out in the child, and the child's going to say, I don't want you, I wish he was my father. That's already an indictment and a condemnation, not on the child. The child's only reacting to an environment that was created. And therefore, the parents have to learn from that reaction. When a father or a child says such a thing, you have to look at yourself. Instead of rebuking the child, instead of screaming, how dare you say that? Usually the flaw in the children is an alarm, it's a siren that the parent must go back to school and reteach himself or herself the proper behavior, and then we can expect such behavior to trickle down into our children. Ladies, next week there is no class because it's before Shavuot.